virus has, of course, played its part in the world's economy. Yet, it seems that the recovery time from the depression caused is something that could be a factor in just how individual economies pick up again, with China seeming to lead the way as it bounces back from the financial impact seen in the year 2020. But it's not just the COVID-19 pandemic that has seen economies rise and fall. As from back in 2010, the Chinese economy began to exponentially gain on the U.S. economy, chart from the CEBR World Economic League table, which also shows that by the year 2028, the Chinese economy will catch up with and surpass that of the U.S. Naturally, China excels when it comes to foreign exports and is hence a major factor in why it is able to recover so well. Yet, as things settle down in China, it is the domestic market that also sees China take an advantage over the U.S., as we can see in this chart over here. Retail sales in China are rising faster than those of the U.S., which is still seeing lockdowns and closures prevent its economy recovering as fast as that of China. Now, in order to take a deeper look into just what is happening on the Sino-American economic front, let's get straight into our first report, which addresses the issue on a deeper level.
The race is on for the world's largest economy as global nations emerge slowly but surely from the devastating effect of the COVID-19 pandemic that rocked economies and cost lives around the world. The two current largest global economies, the United States of America and China, remain locked in horns as per prior to the arrival of the virus. But now it seems, as the world sets out its agenda to recover, is just how fast each nation will be back on its feet, and is something that will no doubt determine just how quickly China catch up with and eventually surpass the US as the world's largest economy.
Before the pandemic, there was clear evidence that China was going to surpass the US in terms of its size of GDP. And on some measures, or GDP measured as purchasing power parity, China had already done that in 2019. So the pandemic itself wasn't the reason for this. This was already happening.
Whereas China has demonstrated that it's been able to successfully return into the black following the pandemic, with factories and shops opening up again and lockdown measures all but eradicated, the opposite is true in the United States, which is still seeing its economy struggle to return to pre-pandemic levels, and is something that will no doubt hinder the rate in which they finally do recover. Furthermore, the US under the leadership of ex-President Donald Trump made it a daily routine to put America first, making sure that its internal economy was the priority, almost ignoring the notion of multilateral trade, something that China has done with great interest, with examples being the Global Belt and Road Initiative and the signing of the regional RCEP agreement, which saw China boost its regional economic sway.
Multilateral trade systems is the answer to promoting world GDP, and also forestalling any kind of military or economic frictions. So, yes, I think trade is the solution to many of the world's problems. The more interdependent we become, the less likely we want to start fighting each other.
With predictions suggesting that the US and China will meet economic parity in 2028, the world, and in particular the US, will be keeping a keen eye on other emerging economic powers, such as India and Russia, as they edge their way up the table, potentially one day pushing the US further down the economic leaderboard.
Joining me in the studio is Current Affairs and Impact Analyst Mahan Abadi. Mahan, welcome.
Pleasure.
And we have our special guest, Ming Du. He's a professor of Chinese Law and Trade and current director of the Center for Chinese Law and Policy at Durham University. Professor, many thanks for being with us today. First up, the U.S. and China, they're jostling for the top spot as the world's largest economy. Now, are we set to see a change in the status quo, do you think? Or is the global financial complex on a radically different route inspired by recent global events?
Thank you for having me today, Kavi. My points to your question are basically two points. First, I think China's economic growth is unstoppable. Barring any major disruptions in international relations, I think China is on its path to the number one economy in the world. But that being said, we should not underestimate the U.S. resilience. Giving the historical examples, U.S. has gone through some even worse major disruption, but somehow it recovered. So I think China is going to be number one, but it may take a little bit of time for China to achieve that spot. Thank you.
Well, Mahan, one of the main reasons that China seems to be catching up with Americans in terms of at least their GDP growth rate, where it counts is the fact that they seem to have emerged from the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of people are talking about that much more quicker and more efficiently than the U.S. has. And, of course, this is being reflected in the economy. Do you think that the U.S. mismanagement is, in essence, the main reason for the Chinese exponential growth rates?
I think the key word here is resilience. The Chinese economy and more broadly the Chinese state and its society are just far more robust and resilient than their Western counterparts. I mean, let's face it, the West just fell apart in the face of this pandemic. Look at the UK, for instance. It has the highest death rate per capita in the world. The US is in disarray in terms of COVID-19. But China, where the virus supposedly originated from, has dealt incredibly well. It suppressed it very early on because it's a much more cohesive country. State and society work very well together.
This particular entry over here talks about how the first country hit by COVID-19, and it says it controlled the disease, but it did not need to repeat economically paralyzing lockdowns as European countries have done. So that, I think that's another important point here in terms of the lockdown, repeated lockdowns.
That speaks to preparedness, both on the part of the state and also on the part of society to accept very harsh measures very early on to get on top of a problem. The problem in the West, specifically Western Europe and North America, is that the society and the state were not in sync, you know.
Very well. Well, thank you so much for that. We do appreciate the comments made there by Mahana and, of course, the professor. Now, in terms of what we're going to see next in this next report that has been prepared, we're going to be hearing from both of them again later, but we're going to look at just how military spending may be having a negative effect on the American economy, something that China seems to have avoided to their advantage.
It can be argued that one of the main reasons that China is catching up with the US is based on two very important factors. The first is the most obvious, namely the way in which the country makes its money, which for China predominantly comes in the form of large manufacturing output, one that essentially sees China being labelled as the factory of the world. But the second factor, and one that may be overlooked by many, is how each nation spends its money. And this is where the real difference comes into play when it comes to comparing the US and China. Although the US enjoys a huge income from its well-established military-industrial complex, the US also spends more than any other nation on military hardware, in fact seeing the US spend over $732 billion in 2020, three times that of China on $261 billion. China, although the world's second largest military spending nation, has used much of its income in investment, in particular when it comes to the technology industry, proving that its research and development in the area has boosted its GDP by leaps and bounds and is something that the US have attempted hard to curb in the implementation of sanctions against various Chinese tech companies, none more so famous than leading Chinese telecommunications company Huawei. Furthermore, the One Belt, One Road initiative has seen China invest into infrastructure, logistics and technology across the world, in fact touching over 140 countries, hence seeing China divert its funding away from the military complex and into investment and long-term strategies, something that has potentially boosted the Chinese economy like none other.
I think the Belt and Road initiative is more an extension of its economic power. In much the same way as the private sector expanded in the British Empire in the 19th century, this expansion of economic power is projected through the Belt and Road Initiative. What's needed in China to sustain its position as the largest economy and the most powerful economy is productivity in China. Trade will go some way towards that, as the Belt and Road Initiative is meant to support, but that in itself is not sufficient.
With the US clearly aware of the fact that China is fast catching up with it, various stalling methods have been placed against China, including the sanctions that we've just mentioned. But more worryingly, seeing the US stoke the flames of tension in places like Hong Kong and Taiwan, something that could cause a Cold War to rapidly warm up.
It could really depend very much on the miscalculation on either side, because for China, domestic consumption of its policy is extremely important, and therefore, if it looks as if they're being threatened by an outside force, their real worry for China is not so much the outside force, but what happens inside. And therefore, that would force them into acting militarily.
Back with me in the studio is Maan Abedin and Professor Ming Du from Durham University. Okay, we go to the professor, see what he has to say. Yep. With this next question, Professor, the U.S. spending trillions of dollars in its military whilst China has concentrated on technological advances, boosting its economy in the process. Do you think the tech industry is China's catalyst to undermining the U.S.?
Kevin, it's true that China is spending millions and billions of dollars on the technology industry. Whether it will overtake the U.S. or undermine the U.S. in this respect, I believe is unclear. Well, the background of China's focus on technology is, of course, technology is China's Achilles heel. For example, China is still unable to produce its own semiconductor chips. The U.S. sanction against the Huawei by prohibiting supply of chips has put a lot of pressure on China's national GNP. So, well, it's indeed a wake-up call for China's government to concentrate its resources on developing some core and key technology. And, well, will China succeed? I believe so. Given time, yes. But it takes time for China to sort out its technology problems and overtake the U.S. in that regard.
Well, Maan, we have to talk about, obviously, how the U.S. has taken great steps to curb the progress that's being made by the Chinese. And one of those was the way that it dealt with Huawei in terms of the way it restricted it, and there were many different facets of the restrictions that happened. Looking at what's said over here, they barred from doing business with Huawei due to national security concerns was the big reason that the U.S. brought, and also supplying equipment for network infrastructure to supply chains, et cetera. Do you think the U.S. made a concerted attempt without holding back to stop China advance technologically?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, under the previous administration, they did everything they could. And Huawei, I think, is actually the best example. They did two things in relation to Huawei. They actually put pressure on Canada to detain one of the executives of Huawei, and she's still under house detention as far as I know. And more importantly, they applied so much pressure on the UK to cease all cooperation with Huawei, because Huawei was tasked with developing the UK's 5G network. And initially, the UK agreed to the deal, and then they reneged on it, saying that it can only have a peripheral role to play. And then the Brits even went further as a result of American pressure and said, we will terminate all cooperation with Huawei before the end of the decade.
Okay, thanks again to Maan on that. We do appreciate it, and of course, the professor. We're gonna, we have plenty more coming up, but right now we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kabatawe. Time now to take a look into the U.S.-China economic sphere in more detail in our in-depth section. Now, as discussed throughout the show already, the COVID-19 pandemic has taken its toll on both the Chinese and the U.S. economies. But as we emerge from the pandemic, a report by the Center for Economics and Business Research suggests that the U.S. economy is expected to grow by around 1.9% annually between the years 2022 and 2024, slowing to 1.6% after that, whereas the Chinese economy is expected to grow by 5.7% annually until 2025, before settling in at 4.5% thereon. Moving on to the next one, as things stand, the U.S. and China are the top two largest economies in the world, with the U.S. enjoying a nominal GDP of $21.44 trillion compared to China's $14.4 trillion. However, when we look at the GDP per capita, due to China's large population, it would only require a GDP per capita half the size of that of the U.S. to see China's overall economy twice the size of that of the U.S. Okay, on to the next one. It seems that it is not just China that is threatening the U.S. position as the world's largest economy, according to Standard Chartered Bank. Once the U.S. falls behind China, it will likely never be able to replace it again. It may even fall behind the rising economy of India. By the year 2030, 35% of the global GDP will be created in Asia, with six of the world's top 10 economies being found in that region. And now on to the next one. It seems the key to success for China is what is called the Belt and Road Initiative, which, unlike the U.S., has seen China avoid spending money on its military, instead investing in the global economy, with figures of between $50 to $100 billion a year being distributed into thousands of projects across Asia, Africa, Europe, and South America, yielding high returns in the process. Time now to take a look at our final report in this episode, as we look into how Sino-U.S. relations may look with a new U.S. president at the helm, one that appears to have already started reversing multiple decisions made by his predecessor, Donald Trump.
Many people, when asked whether Joe Biden will do a better job than Donald Trump when it comes to Sino-American relations, will likely answer words to the effect of, well, he couldn't do any worse. Yet is this really the case? The 46th president of the United States has already shown so much promise in reversing many of the policies set by his predecessor, as demonstrated by the pile of executive orders he signed on his first day in office. However, so far, none of the actions taken by Biden in his first days and weeks in office has pointed to any sign of change in U.S. relations with China. With Biden very much aware that the COVID-19 pandemic has slapped the U.S. economy harder than ever, as well as the notion that the nation he now presides over is more divided than ever, is the gentleman persona that Biden wishes to portray a false flag character? And does the mom and pop look hide the true Biden, who may well turn out to be nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing?
A wolf in sheep's clothing sounds like a good way of describing it. I don't think policy towards China is going to change radically. I think what's going to be different is the way it's going to be projected on the world press. And that's quite important for China, because face-saving policy is extremely important in their thinking. So it'll be a return to the sort of Roosevelt-type policy, that is Theodore Roosevelt policy, that is to speak softly and carry a large stick. So the kind of policy that will be going will be one that will be less confrontational, but it certainly will be challenging China.
But for Joe Biden, the U.S.-China relationship is not something that can just be brushed under the carpet, with the world clearly having to take multiple issues more seriously than ever, be it the environment, security, trade, and of course global health. The U.S. have indicated that both patience and consultation with allies is key as to how the relationship may play out over the next 4 years.
We're starting from an approach of patience as it relates to our relationship with China. So that means we're going to have consultations with our allies, we're going to have consultations with Democrats and Republicans, and we're going to allow the interagency process to work its way through to review and assess how we should move forward with our relationship.
What now remains to be seen is just how patient the U.S. can be. There's no doubt that China is fast on the way to replacing the U.S. as the world's largest economy. And should other Asian nations follow suit, it could be more of a problem than expected for the U.S. However, if there's one thing that Joe Biden will want to leave as an early legacy of his presidency, it's the notion of undoing the mistakes of Trump, be this at home in reuniting his polarized country, or across the international arena, where Trump haphazardly lost the United States so many admirers and friends.
Back for the final time with us on this episode of Economic Divide is Mahan Abedin and also Professor Ming Du. Okay, let's go straight to the professor. Professor, my last question to you, looking to the future of the Sino-U.S. relations. I mean, Joe Biden at this point has taken the helm there in the U.S., reversed many of Donald Trump's policies. Do you think that he will work towards reversing the U.S.-China decoupling policy that was set by Donald Trump, hence easing the ongoing trade war in the process?
Well, no. I think Biden, Biden has lots of differences with Donald Trump, but towards China policy, I think Biden has a very similar view against China. Well, that being said, Biden is going to continue the competitive pressure on China, but Biden might adopt a different strategy. For example, Trump may prefer the unilateral a stance against China, but Biden will make alliances with other countries, with Europeans, with Japan, with other of its allies against China to organize a united front against China. I think that competition, rivalry between China and the United States will continue with the Biden administration, the period.
Okay, Professor Ming Du from the University of Durham, many thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Kavi. Thank you.
Sure. Well, Mahan, it can't be argued that Donald Trump created such a toxic environment when it came to China and also the U.S. It's going to be hard for Biden to make some changes. I mean, we're yet to see really any motions forward by Biden in terms of China. What are we going to see when it comes to Biden making a difference in this whole scenario? Basically, when you take a look at the policy that is put forward, we know the pivot is there, and it's going to remain there in that sphere. But the trade deal is one of the things that needs to be looked at, and this is among the issues that, at this point, the U.S. is reviewing. What direction is it going to take?
Well, you know, Sinophobia is deeply entrenched in the psyche of the U.S. government machinery. So even if Biden wanted to reverse some of Trump's policies in relation to China, I think he's going to find that extremely difficult to pull off. And look, I mean, China, I believe, is going to surprise everybody. I mean, hitherto, China is simply focused on developing its economy, having this global economic reach, without that necessarily translating into diplomatic pull or even military might. But that's about to change. I mean, we saw China being extremely determined to assert full sovereignty over Hong Kong in the face of enormous resistance and pressure from the Americans and the British. But in the end, nothing happened. China asserted full sovereignty, and all the British can do is to give UK passports to their supporters in Hong Kong so they can flee. And you know, whilst the US is focused on these parochial trade issues, trying to hold Chinese technological progress, I think China will just surprise everybody and simply change the weather.
They've made their point clear. We'll have to see how the US is going to take this. I'm sure the US is going to continue down its path. Yeah. Time will tell. Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it, Mahan. Thank you for your input, Mahan Ahmadine there. And also I'd like to thank the director of the University or the Center for Chinese Law and Policy at Durham University, Professor Ming Du, for being on the show. As we enter a new multipolar world order, the way in which nations act and react with each other takes the stage on a host of levels. Whereas traditional competition may have come in the form of military might, today the world sees a combination of many factors, ranging from military, economic, and regional competition, which all play their part in the global arena. For China and the U.S., the Cold War is being fought at an economic level, with a host of tactics being thrown into the ring, including blocking Chinese technology under the shady cloak of national security, to the proxy Cold War is being fought in Hong Kong and in Taiwan, both of which have seen heavy U.S. influence in their ongoing sagas. What now remains to be seen is how the situation will play out as China goes from strength to strength, and the U.S. opens a new chapter in its policy towards China with the new man in the White House. That's all the time we have for this episode. Don't forget, we want to hear your thoughts on this or any other topic. So do get in touch with us by writing to us. In the meantime, on behalf of me, Kavi Tabwe, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters,
11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
According to the policy, there has to be countries and political units in the Middle East region that enjoy five characteristics. First, they have to be weak. Second, they have to be hostile to one another, and they should not be able to unite. As a result, you saw that they followed the policy of strengthening Arab nationalism, Turkish nationalism, and Iranian nationalism for many years. Third, their rulers have to be politically obedient and given to the Western powers. Fourth, they have to be consumers from the economic point of view. That is to say, they have to spend on imports and communerism the money that they earn from selling their oil at a very low price, so that the Western companies can boost their business. Fifth, they have to be scientifically backward, and they should not be given the permission to make scientific progress. These are just general points. It would really take a book to explain them.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah, 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 Allah.
How did they use to prevent scientific progress in our country and certain other countries? They wanted the nations of this region to blindly imitate the Europeans in cultural areas. They wanted the nation of the region to be completely superficial and settle for a kind of religion that is personal and possibly ceremonial. This was the picture that they had in mind, and they prepared policies to achieve this goal. Maybe Western strategists spent thousands of hours to study this issue. Maybe they spent thousands of hours to think about it and make plans. They deployed their agents in the Middle Eastern countries and used them to do what they wanted to do. This analysis can help us to appropriately understand Reza Shah's behavior, Mohammad Reza Shah's behavior and the behavior of Turkey's Mustafa Kemal and many others. This was their plan and they were successful.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
The U.S. President Joe Biden's remarks in his first foreign policy speech included a handful of announcements and intentions, including Washington's decision to halt arms sales to Saudi Arabia in order to avoid the current humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen to be worsened. Biden condemned the Saudi-led war on Yemen, saying it has created a humanitarian and a strategic catastrophe and it has to end. Indeed, 6 years of war and blockade in Yemen has taken a heavy toll on the country. Thousands have lost their lives in the Saudi-led attacks, while millions lost their homes or abandoned them to run away from the horrors of war. But the degree which the U.S. was involved was confirmed by a New York Times article, facts that were not well known up to this point. The article stated that Saudi F-15 jets were not only serviced by American mechanics, but also American technicians upgraded the targeting software and other classified technology. Saudi commanders sat with American military officials who provided intelligence and tactical advice, which included dropping American bombs. UNICEF has called Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with over 24 million in dire need of help. Washington has been the biggest arms supplier of Riyadh during the first 5 years of Yemen war, as it provided three-quarters of Saudi's arms imports. For Washington, halting arms sales to Riyadh is not a cost-effective decision, even though Biden has promised to do so. It appears that Biden is using a double standard policy. He claims he wants to end the Yemen war and stop selling arms to Riyadh, which means losing billions of dollars of income. Contrastingly, he promises to provide defensive support for Saudi Arabia to defend itself against Yemeni attacks. The Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reacted to Biden's speech, saying that Yemenis do not trust Washington's words on ending the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Ansarullah also says the establishment of real peace in the war-hit country is only possible if the Saudi-led attacks and blockade end, signaling that Yemen seeks real action to solve the problem, not just words. Despite Joe Biden's show of reversing former U.S. President Donald Trump's foreign policy, it seems Biden is using a hypocritical policy in dealing with Yemen war.
Well, the situation in terms of Saudi Arabia and the war against Yemen has been going on now for several years. I don't think the Biden position is really any different, essentially, from the point of view of the Yemeni people who have been suffering. We have to remember, of course, this kind of terminology that's used about military hardware being used for defensive capabilities. No military hover is made for defensive capabilities if it's being used against a population, as we've seen in the Yemen. So I don't anticipate there's going to be that much of a difference in terms of this policy decision from the point of view of whether the United States is supporting the Saudi regime or not.
In his first foreign policy speech, the U.S. President Joe Biden indicated that his administration will deal with Russia differently, saying the time of the U.S. ruling over in the face of Russia's aggressive actions, including election interference and cyber attacks, is over, and that Washington will not hesitate to raise the cost on Russia. The U.S. President made it clear that Washington is keen on pushing back Russian threats and human rights abuse. Biden also condemned detention of the Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny and called for his immediate release. He also urged Moscow to hold using force against opposition protests. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while the Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. It also backed police actions against what it calls unauthorized rallies. Biden made those remarks while his administration moved quickly to extend the New START arms control treaty with Russia. The extension of this landmark arms control treaty will limit the number of nuclear missiles and warheads each country can deploy. But how could Moscow and Washington reach this agreement despite their disagreements?
Their concern is China rather than Russia. For the United States, the situation in Russia is a bit of a sideshow. They're not really sure what's happening on the ground. We know there are elements from the United States who are trying to destabilize Russia as we speak, and the situation with Navalny is very fluid indeed. So I think the Russians are, in a sense, going about their business, and the Americans are waiting in the wings to see what happens. So I think really in terms of geopolitics, the Biden administration is much more concerned with China as a superpower, as what it would define as a challenge to US hegemony. And I think with the situation in Russia, United States will be playing both sides of the game.
While the U.S. President Joe Biden claimed his administration policy to deal with Russia's foreign policy is head-on, Biden has shown a double-standard approach. On one hand, he denounces Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny's arrest, but on a wider scale, he rushes to reach an accord with Kremlin. With this hypocrisy in Washington's foreign policy, where does Biden's policy with Russia lie?
Italians are in the midst of a multifaceted crisis. Italy has been hit particularly hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, with one of the highest death tolls in the world. The Eurozone's third biggest economy is meanwhile suffering from one of the worst downturns in decades. And now, political chaos triggered by the collapse of the coalition government last week is making the situation much worse. Some say it is the most perilous time for Italians since World War II. Italian President Sergio Mattarella has brought in this man to try to resolve the situation and put Italy on the right track, Mario Draghi, former head of the European Central Bank. He received a mandate earlier this week to form a new coalition government. Hopes are high for Draghi to find a way forward.
Well, Mario Draghi certainly has the experience of high-level politics and is broadly respected by both politicians and by the population. The man who famously said, whatever it takes, is broadly credited with saving the euro following the last recession in 2008-2009 and the subsequent sovereign debt crisis. So he definitely has the respect of people. Whether that then can translate into forming but maintaining a government in Italy remains to be seen.
Italy's financial markets reacted positively to a sudden arrival on the political scene. The star technocrat is extremely efficient under pressure. He steered the Eurozone through the financial crisis during his tenure as president of the European Central Bank. He is widely credited with saving both the Eurozone and the euro currency. His performance as the president of the European Central Bank became a source of national pride for Italians. The 73-year-old economist now has broad support among many major political parties. But Italian politics is a dangerous place, especially for technocrats and economists like him. After losing his Senate majority last week, Giuseppe Conte resigned as Italian prime minister. The crisis was triggered after a decision by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to withdraw his liberal Italia Viva party out of the centrist coalition government. Renzi was opposed to Conte's plan to spend well over 200 billion euros of EU recovery funds on the coronavirus crisis. Observers believe doubts about the outgoing government's ability to properly spend the money led to its collapse. But Draghi is widely believed to be capable of handling such sums because he is an experienced economist. But has he really got what it takes to be Italy's next prime minister? He is right now trying to unite as many political parties as he can. The former ECB chief wants to secure broad cross-party support because of the daunting challenges facing Italy.
Italy is particularly difficult to form and maintain a government. The main reason is that it usually requires a fairly broad coalition of a number of different political parties. What that does is put together people with competing ideologies or competing and differing views of how the government and indeed the country should be run. This creates a situation where the smaller parties actually have disproportionate amount of power.
So far, the centre-left Democratic Party has given him its backing. Renzi's Italia Viva party has pledged unconditional support for Draghi. Centre-right Forza Italia, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, also suggested that it might be ready to help out. But the right-wing league insists that it will not support a government backed by Five Star. All eyes are on Draghi now. He is considered a hero for the Eurozone. Can he unite the Italians at this time of crisis?
Hezbollah said it shot down an Israeli drone near the border town of Blida. The downing of the drone comes as the Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spying operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. But Tel Aviv's frequently violating Lebanon's airspace is seen by many as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and the country's sovereignty.
I think that Israel really is disregarding territorial sovereignty in general in Lebanon, in Gaza, and other places as well, Syria, Iraq. Israel has bombed militia in Iraq, and it's also involved. It's attacked forces in Libya as well. So I don't think that Israel really cares about honoring international protocols, international law. It just, at will violate any country's territory as long as it feels it's in its interest to do so. And I think it's been violating Lebanese territory for decades, really.
But such Israeli violations are not limited to Lebanon. On Tuesday, Palestinian resistance forces downed an Israeli drone in southern Gaza and took control of it. The Israeli military confirmed one of its drones crashed in Gaza, but claimed there was, quote, no danger of information leak. On Sunday, Palestinian fighters also shot down an Israeli quadcopter, which was conducting an espionage mission over Beit Hanun crossing in Gaza's northern border with the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently uses drones over the Gaza Strip either to monitor and photograph Palestinian military units or bomb specified targets.
example?
It uses drones regularly in Lebanon, I think, too, and in the Gaza Strip. It uses them for intelligence gathering. It's trying to watch what people do in those places. It's looking for militant activities that could be construed as, building missiles. It's looking for people that might be building tunnels under Gaza to defend Gaza in the next battle invasion from Israel. So these drones are an important intelligence tool for Israel. And drones are important intelligence tools for all the countries that make drones, the United States as well, and in countries where it's involved in the Middle East.
Israel does not only use drones to sneak into the Lebanese airspace. Its U.S.-made F-35 stealth jets have also violated the country's airspace multiple times. In late January, Lebanese media said the Israeli regime used F-35 and F-15 warplanes to fly over the cities of Nabatiya, Eqlim Tufa, and Tyre. They said it was the first time F-35 jets were used on such missions and that the flights were conducted at high altitude. Israeli aircraft has routinely breached the Lebanese airspace since 2000, when the regime was forced by Hezbollah to withdraw from Lebanon's south. The Lebanese government has filed hundreds of protest letters with the UN over airspace violations by Israel since the 2000 withdrawal. The letters have failed in ending Israel's almost daily breaching of Lebanon's sovereignty. Observers say Tel Aviv's overflights could be meant to send a message to Lebanon.
Well, I think that Israel views Hezbollah in Lebanon as a prime rival and a prime opponent. So Israel continuously sends its F-16s and F-35s over Lebanon. It also sends them up to attack Syria. So I think that I don't know that they're sending a message about the drones, but I think that they really want to track what Hezbollah is doing. They want to find out what plans it has. They want to track any missiles that may be coming through Syria into Lebanon so that they can keep track of that for the next time that there's a war, an invasion by Israel of Lebanon.
Israel has waged numerous wars against regional countries since it was installed in West Asia following World War II. The regime enjoys full support from its Western creators, most notably the U.S., Britain, and France. The U.S. alone has used its veto power at the U.N. Security Council many times to shield Tel Aviv from the full force of international law. This has further emboldened the regime to continue down the path it started in 1948.
When the United Kingdom handed over control of Hong Kong back to the Chinese in July 1997, various agreements were made in order for the island to maintain some kind of autonomy. However, over two decades later, Hong Kong is very much an integral part of China, and hence why China sees all affairs surrounding the island as sovereign business. Yet, following the implementation of the National Security Law, preventing a variety of crimes, including secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion, the UK promised to issue eligible Hong Kong residents citizenship to Britain, something that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has recently reiterated he will honour. The ability for Hong Kong residents to apply for the special visa may see hundreds of thousands of people apply to travel, live and settle in the UK, and has seen immigration offices in Hong Kong see a surge in demand for applications as the process begins to fall into place. However, China has taken offence to the offer by the British, with the Chinese Foreign Affairs spokesman Zhao Linjian stating that the move grossly interferes with Chinese internal affairs. He further stated that China will no longer recognise BNO passports as valid travel documents. Furthermore, Chinese authorities are baffled as to why residents would want to leave Hong Kong and head to the UK, claiming that once they arrive there, they'll be considered as second-class citizens, something that China may very well have a point on when one considers the levels of discrimination and racism against foreigners in Britain, meaning that new arrivals could fast become targets of British anti-hospitality, something that the Brits have a long and tarnished record of. What now remains to be seen is just when and how so many new residents will make their way over to the UK,
in particular as Britain faces the toughest ever travel measures amongst the peak of the COVID-19 virus, which has already killed in excess of 100,000 British people already. As Britain comes to the stark realisation that leaving the EU may have caused more problems than benefits, it seems that one thing that was not calculated was a sudden resentment towards Europeans, in particular Eastern Europeans, who made up a significant percentage of the low-skilled workforce in Britain, meaning that many EU citizens felt they were no longer welcome in the country.
During my previous 6 years in the UK, I was contributing to the economy here. I cherished Britishness. I worked in companies such as Barclays and subsequently British Airways, and most of my working life has been concentrated on public sector. And then one snap decision destroyed it all, and suddenly I felt, I actually do not belong here. I am no longer welcome.
It's hence why Britain needed to find an alternative source of labour to fill the void as Europeans leave the UK and head back to their home countries in the European Union. And hence why Boris Johnson, when asked what he would do about the Hong Kong situation, saw an opportunity waiting to be developed. Boris Johnson is no doubt using the opportunity for BNO status holders in Hong Kong to find a way into the UK, and hence why suddenly, unlike European citizens who no longer feel welcome, he claims he's proud to allow the people of Hong Kong to live and work in Britain. After all, his economy depends on having a wide range of workforces. So bad is the labour drain in Britain that the number of Europeans having left the country has seen EU citizens' levels in Britain at their lowest for over 5 years, meaning that more people are leaving Britain than actually entering the country. And with Brexit being such a dividing topic in Britain, the government have gone one step further by secretly adding EU nations to the so-called voluntary return scheme, which actually pays EU citizens to get out of Britain, covering their flight costs and also providing £2,000 in a cash envelope in the process, showing just how deep Britain's discrimination and hatred of the EU really is. What now remains to be seen is whether the people of Hong Kong are genuinely willing to fall into the trap that their Eastern European predecessors managed to escape from in Britain, and whether actually leaving Hong Kong and truly becoming second-class citizens is better than living in their own country.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبری.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
کوهستان چشم می گشاید شب در سپید دم تاریخ
و فرام شد هفت قلعه تو در تو به نام نامی ایزد به نشان یک تا خواستی
My beautiful country, Iran, is an ancient land. Today we are going to take a trip to the heart of the history of Iran, to a very old site in the beautiful city of Hamadan, to Hekmatane Hill. Hekmatane Hill is an ancient hill dating back to 3,000 years ago. This hill is home to an underground city which dates back to the era of Medes. The area of this hill is about 30 hectares, which sits in the northern part of the old city of Hamadan. According to archaeologists and researchers, this site has relics of three historical eras of Medes, Achaemenids, and Parthians. The result of scientific excavations is the emergence of a vast ancient city, a kind of chessboard architecture of Parthian era. This unique complex, in addition to having advanced system of water pipelines, has an adobe wall with a diameter of about 10 meters, which has huge towers in certain distances. The main structure of the ancient city of Hekmatane is made of adobe and partially bricks in some districts. I am now at the entrance of the complex of Hekmatane Hill. In order to reach the ancient structures of this complex, I have to walk a little. Hamadan is very cold in this time of the year. I better zip up my hood or I will freeze. I am now in Hekmatane Museum. This museum has really attractive sections. Next to me, on the ground, there is a window showcase. I better get closer to see what's inside. Oh my god! Human skeleton! This skeleton dates back to 2,500 years ago. This human skeleton seems to have broad legs close to stomach, as if squatting, leaning forward from the waist. Well, next to it, there are clay pots. I am now in the ancient city of Hekmatane. Here, there are building units which have a central yard and the stores have been built around them symmetrically. To be honest, I can't imagine the real existence of these houses in my mind. These houses and the passages between them date back to several thousand years ago. Here is much different from the kind of conception we have about city or home. Much different. Oh, these ancient sites make us contemplate more. Who used to live here? What was it like living in this place? Well, I have to walk so that I could think better. How cold is it here?
Until next time, goodbye.